Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's a scene that might be familiar to a lot of divorced parents. You're on the phone with your child, you're desperate to connect, and one way or another, it feels like you keep missing each other. Tim El-Haj writes about that feeling in his piece, As a Father, I Was Hardly a Perfect Fit. It's read by John C. Reilly, who stars in the new film, The Sisters Brothers.
During our weekly telephone call, my 10-year-old son told me he wanted a Yankees cap. Not just any Yankees cap. It had to be a fitted cap. Fitted caps don't have the plastic adjuster on the back, he told me. All the pro players wear them. Although fitted caps cost only about $30 or $35, I didn't think I could afford one. I lived alone in a small apartment in the Bronx, nearly 200 miles from my son and my ex-wife, who remained in the Pennsylvania town where I had spent most of my life. I was barely getting by in a variety of part-time jobs while putting myself through school. Besides, we had just been through the financial double whammy of Christmas and his birthday. I was about to tell him as much, but then I heard his mother in the background, and she sounded irritated. "Don't ask him for that." Her voice was muffled, and I knew my son was holding the phone to his chest. The way she stressed the word him irritated me. "Why not ask me?" "Your head's still growing," I heard her say. "What a waste." I realized she probably couldn't afford the cap either. This awareness brought me to my feet. As the product of a Roman Catholic upbringing, I couldn't help but feel guilty about my divorce, even though I wasn't the one who had asked for it. My feelings of shame and inadequacy were manifested in both a tacit and an overt way. For me, divorce wasn't just the end of the marriage. It was the start of a great competition. The fact that my son wanted something that his mother was either unwilling or unable to provide only steeled my resolve to get it for him. "What size is your head?" I asked. He didn't know. "Go to the mall," I told him. "Try on fitted caps until you find the right size." He sounded delighted. I was too. I had both upstaged his mother and found a parental task only I could perform. Considering my circumstance, this was huge. With work and school, I managed to visit my son just a few times a year. Otherwise, our relationship consisted entirely of those weekly phone calls, during which he often had little to say, and we had increasingly less to talk about. Some subjects were off-limits, money issues or anything vaguely critical of his parents or their decisions. I especially knew not to comment on the eagerness with which he called his stepfather Dad. When I called the following weekend, he still didn't know his hat size. He hadn't been able to get to the mall. His mother wouldn't take him. "I used to walk to the mall from that neighborhood as a child. Can't you walk?" His mother wouldn't let him walk on Route 441. I sighed. "Well, cut through Grasshopper Hill." He had no idea what I meant. I asked him about the streets and his routes and such, and eventually I realized a housing development had been built where Grasshopper Hill used to be. He didn't know Grasshopper Hill, and neither did any of his friends. The small town where I grew up seemed to exist only in my memory now. Though I was just 31, I was out of touch, demoted by my absence. I suggested he use his stepfather's tape measure to determine the size of his head. He said it was a metal tape, and he would get in trouble if he were to break it. "If it's metal," I said, "you can't break it. What if the sharp edge cuts my head?" I rolled my eyes. In desperation, I told him the first thing that came into my mind. "Okay, unwind a wire hanger and wrap it around your head. Then use the tape to measure the section of the hanger. As soon as I said it, I knew how absurd it was.
That sounds even more dangerous than just using the metal tape, he said. And anyway, I can't be unwinding Mom's hangers. Are you trying to get me in trouble?
Every week I came to dread asking him the size of his head, but I couldn't let it go. After so many years of missed birthday parties and unattended Little League games, the struggle to determine the size of his head seemed like my one slim shot at redemption. Invariably, every conversation came down to the same simple question: how big is your head? This went on, incredibly, for more than 6 months. Toward the end of summer, he finally offered an answer. 7 7/8. 7 7/8? I could hardly believe it. Pay dirt. Yep, he said with gusto, real authority. You sure? I am, Dad, I am. I took the train to Madison Square Garden. 8th Avenue had dozens of little souvenir shops with Yankees caps in the window. I searched for a fitted cap that was a 7 7/8. There were none. They had plenty of 7 1/8, plenty of 7 1/4, even a few 7 5/8, but not a single 7 7/8 cap was to be found. I went to 4 more stores, and it was the same story. Macy's was my last hope. When I finally found a cap that was 7 7/8, I was taken aback by its girth. It looked as if it would fit a jack-o'-lantern. How could a 10-year-old have a head this big? At Macy's, the cap was $40, almost 20% more than the little stores by the garden. But the poor child had already been cheated by circumstances beyond his control. All he needed to be happy was a size 7 7/8 Yankees cap. I laid my money down. Back in my apartment, I carefully packaged it. Then I took it to the post office. Because his name is the same as mine, he used to complain that the mail carrier often delivered his mail to my mother's house and not across the street on a stretch of houses known as the zoo. I wanted this delivery to be perfect, so I wrote a note in big letters across the package. Dear Mr. Postman, please deliver across the street in the zoo. Thank you. A few days later, I called. His stepfather answered. Did the hat arrive? It did, he said. Does it fit? He paused, and then he said, yeah, it fits. Timmy got on the phone. In an irritated voice, he told me never to write a note on a package again. The only thing worse than living in a little house on a block everyone calls the zoo is having a package arrive with a note blazed across it asking the post office to please deliver it across the street to the zoo. I blustered an apology. But does the hat fit, son? I asked. How does it look? Yeah, he said. It fits. Although he still sounded sullen, he thanked me. We talked a little more, and then the phone was passed to his mother. She asked if I had sent the child support, and I said, oh, yes. The check is in the mail. And it was. I asked her if the hat fit, and she laughed. Yep, it fits. After hanging up, I couldn't figure out why I didn't feel more heroic. Months passed. Years. The cap was long forgotten, at least by me. Eventually, my little apartment in the Bronx gave way to a little house in the suburbs, a new wife, and 2 small children. Before I knew it, Timmy was 20. And over the 4th of July weekend, the 5 of us got together for a trip to Manhattan. Despite all my years in New York, this was Timmy's first time in the big city. In Times Square, he wanted to buy himself a Yankees cap. With a playful look in his eye, he asked me if I remembered the time I sent him that fitted cap. Of course. Well, there's more to the story, he said, but I'm not sure I should even tell you. I urged him to tell me. How bad could it be? He said he had guessed the size of his head that day, and his estimate had come in a little high. 7 7/8 wasn't his hat size when he was 10. In fact, he pointed out, his head still had not achieved that colossal glory. When he put on the cap I had sent, it sank over both his ears. His mother and stepfather had a good laugh. At first, I wasn't sure how to take this news. I didn't like the thought of anyone laughing at my efforts, especially my ex-wife and her husband. And then the frustration of that summer came flooding back. All those phone calls, my trip to the souvenir shops,
The clerks looking at me incredulously each time I mentioned the size I was seeking. 7 7/8, man, that's a mighty big head for a boy. How hard it was to be close when he was growing up. Especially once I faced the fact that he and I would never have a conventional father-son relationship. How I longed to be present for him despite my circumstances. Yet I was so determined to overcome all these obstacles and be a hero that I had ignored the obvious. Even if the cap had fit, it wouldn't have mattered much. It wouldn't have made up for my absence or brought us closer. But the wonder is that those years of weekly phone calls, as difficult as they were, and as insignificant as they felt at the time, did manage to hold us together. As it turned out, they were just enough. Now, watching my son mugging in the store's mirror as he tried on a cap, I couldn't help but smile myself. After 10 long years, it was time for us to have our own little laugh.
That's John C. Reilly reading Tim Elhaj's piece, As a Father, I Was Hardly a Perfect Fit. We'll catch up with Tim and his son after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
What's up, Pop?
Hey, how's it going, man?
Nothing. This is awesome, man.
That's Tim Elhaj and his son, also named Tim, talking to each other from opposite coasts. Tim Sr. lives in Seattle these days, and his son lives on a military base in Massachusetts. Tim Jr. says that he was at a law enforcement training center when his dad called to tell him that this piece had been published in Modern Love, and he went to a Starbucks to read the essay for the first time.
I remember it taking me like 20 minutes to find that section, and then when I read it, I was blown away by it. And I cried. You know, I'm in a federal law enforcement training center. I'm this big, tough guy. Here I am, 240 pounds, and I'm crying. I'm weeping in the Starbucks. I was just telling people that I had, you know, allergies were pretty bad down here for me. So I remember exactly where I was, and I was blown away by the piece.
Tim Sr. says that he wrote this piece about the time he was trying to figure out how to be present in his son's life, even from a distance.
I just wanted to connect and never really felt like I was doing a really great job of it, and just, you know, wanted to be there and just like sort of feeling like an outsider, you know, and just sort of like trying to figure out like how to be the best outsider I could be. It's just really hard. Just like a lot of longing there. And I think that's what drove like just like wanting to make this thing happen. And then just getting, like, fixated on it in this, like, really crazy, unhealthy sort of way.
We asked Tim Jr. what he remembers about those phone calls when his dad kept asking about the size of his head.
You know, he's calling me in the months of the summertime, and I grew up with so many kids, and I was a very active kid. You know, I keep my mom yelling at me, "Your dad's on the phone, come in the house," and I get in there, and just to remember that, oh, I didn't get the hat size again. And I know he's going to ask me. You know, I just remember that buildup for that summer. And I'm sure it was uncomfortable for him. And that's what eventually led me to 7 7/8 for a hat size, which really should have been 7 1/8 with the fitted hats that I have nowadays.
As an adult head, yeah.
Yeah.
That was so crazy. I remember, you know, just telling myself, don't ask about the hat, don't ask about the hat, and just not being able to resist. And it's more about me sort of like torturing my son to get this thing done.
Tim Jr. says that on that trip to New York years later, the family ended up in a store where he found a 7 7/8 hat.
There was one like on the very top shelf, and I pulled it down and I put it on, and you know, it went down to my nose. You know, that's how big it was. And that was me as a 20-year-old. You know, he got me that when I was 10. and we had a laugh. You know, we had a laugh.
But when Tim Jr. talks about what this essay means to him, he gets a little more serious.
You know, I love him, and you know, I've been up and down with my emotions towards my father. And there's one thing that he always offers me. He's always been consistent since I was young. You know, I could not talk to him for 6 7 months and pick up the phone and call him. And it's like we didn't skip a beat. You know, it speaks to that.
And Tim Sr. says that although he's had to work through the guilt of being away for much of his son's life, he takes a huge amount of pride in the man his son has become.
He started this really beautiful, gorgeous family. I go to him for his perspective. He's just a heck of a father and a heck of a man, and I'm just so, so proud of him. I just admire you so much, son, and just thank you so much for coming and showing up for me, and I really, really appreciate it.
I love you a ton, man. I really appreciate you always being there for me when I need you. So thank you.
That's Tim El-Haj Jr. and Tim El-Haj Sr. Tim Sr.'s twins are college age now, and Tim Jr. is also a father. He says that's the most fulfilling role he's ever had. We've got more after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Being a father of a son myself, this piece really hit me. You know, his desperation to connect with his son, that desperation in itself is a measure of love, that idea that the sort of panicky feeling of time slipping away and a bond unraveling simply because you aren't with that person, and how you try to make up for that is just an indication of how much you care and how much you want to care in a way that will matter. And this funny anecdote about the hat being, whatever, 20 sizes too big or something, how that comes out and becomes sort of a sweet bonding moment at the end, I thought was just such a nice touch.
John C. Reilly says he chose this piece because it resonates with the themes of his new movie, The Sisters Brothers.
A lot of it is about recognizing the frailty in men, despite their kind of macho appearance or whatever. It's a movie about recognizing the fact that all human beings are sensitive. So this one definitely seemed in line with that.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Elpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Perotti. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.